We're joined now on the line by Michael Healy-Ray, an incoming junior minister in this government, if indeed they ever get to vote on ministers or Taoiseach or any of that. Michael, can I first get your reaction to what's happened today?
Well, first of all, we thought that the transition to President Trump was going to be difficult. We never thought this was going to be the situation in Ireland today. So I suppose what we're seeing here today is unprecedented. I would have hoped that we would have got the business of electing a Taoiseach and electing a government over us today. But unfortunately, we're in the situation that we're in. And I really don't see, after there being so many suspensions, so many delays, I would have thought that it could have been sorted out and that we would have got that very important job of work over us. I'm disappointed that we are where we are. But the long and the short of it is, we are where we are.
And are you where we are at the moment, Michael Healy-Ray, because you and others and within the government are trying to pull a political stroke here by giving opposition speaking time to government-supporting TDs?
The precedent is there in the past. You had a confidence and supply arrangement where Fianna Fáil were in opposition. And at the same time, they were allowed to speak inside the Dáil. Yeah. You had a situation in the past when... No, you asked me a question.
We've heard these precedents all day, and the problem is none of them directly fit this particular example, which is that you had TDs who formed a group and went into programme for government negotiations with the government, agreed a programme for government, agreed to support the government in good days and in bad, and then said they want to sit in the opposition benches. I haven't been given a precedent for those exact circumstances yet.
Well, do you know the way we leave this now? You rang me a while ago, as in 2 minutes ago, and I was asked to come on and to answer a question. If you were going to ask a question and answer it yourself, the best thing I can do is go away and let you talk away yourself. I wanted to make a point, and if I can't make it, will I just leave you talk away yourself?
No, I'm putting a question to you, Michael Healy-Ray, and I'd really love an answer. Can you give me an example of the situation that I've outlined to you there, where a group goes into programme for government negotiations, agrees a programme for government, and then asks to sit in the opposition benches? Can you give me the precedent for that?
Can I talk now?
Yes, please. I'd love an answer.
No, because if you want to keep talking, I'll keep listening. Do you know a problem? Or I will go away and I'll let you talk away yourself.
Go on.
Right. The late Jackie Healy-Ray and a group of others, many years ago, they agreed to support a government through good times and through bad times, which they did. And they kept a government in place. And at the same time, they were allowed to stand up inside in the Dáil and speak on local and national issues, which they did for a long period of time. There were people like Mildred Fox, the late Harry Blaney, the late Jackie Healy-Ray, and plenty others. We had a situation in 2016 where people were making their point and when they were talking inside and raising issues, and at the same time, they were supporting the government. Michael Lowry and others in the past, from 2020 until just now, were in opposition, and at the same time, they were supportive.
So can I ask you haven't answered my question, which is whether any of those people...
Michael, it's a fair question.
Did any of those people agree a programme for government and enter programme for government negotiations?
If you want to keep on this tone, I'll just let you answer.
It's not a tone, it's a simple question.
For the last time now, I'll just tell you, I'll go away. If you want to keep talking, I will go away. So if I'm not going to be given the opportunity, and like I say, your producer rang me and said, would I come on the programme?
Yeah.
I agreed to come on and you won't let me talk. So it's fine. I'll go away.
Well, I'm very happy to let you talk, but I would like you to answer the question. Has Michael Healy-Ray left us? Well, maybe he might come back and answer the question at another time. I think we've Michael Collins on the line. And I just want to bring Niamh back in just briefly. And Niamh, thank you for holding on the line there. In terms of where this goes, what do you think of the potential compromise that Maria is talking about there that has been put forward, that there will be a vote next year?
Yeah, look, we welcome the vote that's going to happen next year. But as Maria has mentioned, you know, like, they aren't camogie players, the people that are delegates, and sadly it went to Congress last year and it was overturned, you know. So we welcome it and we hope that there would be a favourable vote and we can get out and we can, you know, advocate for how uncomfortable we are and get it everyone around Ireland, I suppose, which has been done the last couple of weeks there, to show that how uncomfortable it is, and, you know, give the players a choice. However, you know, we would hope that there would be a derogation rule in place, because I think it's it seems a bit nonsensical to us to make the stand for this year and then for saying, yeah, okay, you can have it now, but it will go to Congress next year and it might or might not pass, but you'd have to wear scarves for the rest of the year. Do you know, I think that makes it a bit of a farce, it's
too little too late, effectively, is yes. What you're saying on that. Can I just ask you very finally about this text that we've got in, Niamh, saying perhaps redesigned skirts might be appropriate. It would be a pity to go for shorts like men. A bit of femininity is nice and should be encouraged. Niamh, I would... I don't think that was Niamh's response, but who knows? And thank you, Niamh Brockett, for joining us. I think we've lost her off the line. Kneecap, the band, has come in for some praise and also some criticism following its performance at the Coachella Music Festival in California last weekend. The hip-hop trio from Belfast projected pro-Palestine and anti-Israel messages onto screens on stage during its performance. Some commentary online has called for their working visas to be revoked as a result. We were joined on the line now by Kneecap's manager, Daniel Lambert. And Daniel, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us on the programme this evening.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Can you tell me what has been the reaction to the performance and the messages that you portrayed?
A beautiful reaction has been the hundreds of young Americans who came up to us at Coachella to the lads to say that they had said something that wasn't being said in America and that these kids believed in. And that was said to us by young girls, young boys, people in their 20s, 30s. And so many people came up to say that thank you for saying what is right, what is just, and something that sadly isn't said enough.
And I know some people were also offended. Can you understand why some people were offended?
I think that once you move into that space, you're buying into moral hysteria. You know, the real issue here is that somewhere between 50 and 100,000 people have been murdered. 20,000 of them are children. And, you know, if somebody is offended by what were factual images and what was said on the screens, and I'm happy to tell you what was said on the screens, is that Israel is committing a genocide against the people of Palestine. Ireland supports the case that South Africa has taken, so Ireland supports that position. The second thing that was said on the screens was that this genocide has been armed and enabled by the US government. And I don't think that anybody could deny that. So, you know, if somebody's hurt by the truth, that's something for them to be hurt by, but it's really important to speak truth. And thankfully, the lads are not afraid to do that.
Just on the point of genocide, the current legal position is that the International Court of Justice judges have concluded that some of the acts that South Africa have alleged in their case, if proven, would fall under the United Nations Convention on Genocide. Just in terms of the anti-Israel messages that you posted, we have, Daniel, spoken to many people from Israel on this programme who are opposed to what the Israeli government is doing, like Alonly Green, who's a high-profile protester in Israel, or Gideon Levy, who's a high-profile columnist, relatives of hostages. There are regular protests in Israel now from some members of the population to stop the war. Are you painting everyone in Israel with the same brush, or do you run that risk?
Absolutely not. No, I think when you refer to Israel in a messaging as we did, that you're referring to the Israeli government, it's impossible to name all of the people. There's so many of Israeli government ministers. I think, too, like you've mentioned there in terms of the case, Euromed have said yesterday, and I'll just read this out for you, Israeli forces have deliberately targeted 37 aid distribution centres and 28 food banks as part of a systematic and deliberate policy to starve civilians. Now, how we're not leading with that as the topic of discussion rather than the opinions of individuals who felt hurt by factual information is just something that I can't understand.
Okay, and you will know, Daniel, that Israel will deny that they are deliberately starving individuals, but I take the point that what Euromed has said. Kneecap posted this morning about the, and I'll quote, hundreds of Zionist threats that they've received, mixed in with what they say are thousands of well wishes. Can you tell me what sort of threats has the band received?
It'd be too severe to tell you on this call and on radio at this time of day, to be honest. As you could probably imagine the types of things yourself. But I do think even when you've said there a minute ago, like, you know, the UN Special Rapporteur has spoken, RTE, we consistently bring this back to the opinion of the Israeli government. Time and time again, the statements of the Israeli government have been proven to be lies. Most recently, the execution of 15 medical workers and the burying of them and their ambulances in a shallow grave. It was all lies. And once the information and the video came out, they changed the story. The murder of Shireen, the journalist, the Washington Post, a comprehensive investigation showed she was deliberately targeted by the IDF. At what point here do we stop amplifying messages that are consistently proven to be incomplete and inaccurate. When do we do that?
Can I ask you just when you say the threats are too severe that you've received, have they included death threats that the band has received?
They have, yeah.
Yeah. And are they detailed or are any of them anything that the band is worried about? I mean, to the point that you'd need to notify Gardaí?
I think that to the band's massive credit, there's three working class young people here who've built a career for themselves on the basis of the Irish language and music and culture and identity. And they have the bravery and the conviction, especially given where they've come from in post-conflict society, to stand up for what's right, and are willing to do that despite the fact that it may harm their career, despite the fact that it may harm their income. And they should be praised, massively for that. It's an extremely strong position for young people to take, especially young people from a working class background.
Yeah, and on that point about whether it could harm the band's career, I see Nika posting today that you've sold out lots of upcoming performances. So on that side, it doesn't seem to have caused you any harm. But some of the performances are, for example, in Boston. And you'll have seen Sharon Osbourne calling for your US visas to be revoked. The Trump administration, we know from the last couple of months, cracking down really hard on anyone who's expressing pro-Palestine views. Do you have any concern you'll have any trouble getting into the US or that your US visas might be revoked?
But again, like we're talking about, like the opinion of Sharon Osbourne, like, and again, it was said by Ms. Albanese on your program or on a similar program. Why aren't we talking about the opinion of someone like Omar Bartov, who's an Israeli-American genocide expert who concludes that Israel's committing genocide? Why should we care what Sharon Osbourne thinks? I certainly don't.
No, sorry, I, it's not really about whether she's right or wrong. I'm just wondering whether you have concerns about getting into the US in future, and aside from Sharon altogether, or Sharon Osbourne altogether, what the Trump administration, you know, they've sent out a very clear message about where they stand on this, and they've done that with their actions on pro-Palestine protesters in the US. So, like, have you had any indication at all that there may be problems? Are you concerned there may be problems getting back into the US?
Our concern is for the well-being of Palestinian kids and the tens of thousands of Palestinians and millions of Palestinians who now have no home and are being bombed daily. That's where people's concern should lie.
You were working in the emergency department in the Al-Aqsa Hospital. I know it's very difficult, as you say, to put into words some of what you saw, but can you tell us some of your, I suppose, strongest memories of what you saw working there day to day?
Yeah, so, you know, the entire infrastructure of healthcare in Gaza has been systematically destroyed. And so there's only three public hospitals left, Al-Aqsa being one of them. And it was never meant to be a trauma hospital, but every hospital is a trauma hospital now in Gaza. And what we would have is a combination of medical patients that are overloading the healthcare infrastructure because there's no medications, no refrigerations for insulin and those type of things. And so the ER is full of people just ill from the exacerbations of their chronic medical problems. And then every 6 to 12 hours, we would get a mass casualty event where we would have people, children, you know, women, civilians coming in pieces to the hospital in different stages of death and dying. The experience of really feeling for the first time in my career that no matter how well I was trained and no matter how long I've been doing this, that so many people, we just couldn't help. There was a helplessness and a hopelessness in recognizing that many of the people that were coming to our doors with their family members holding them in their arms were not going to be able to be helped because there were no supplies. We didn't have enough hands and bodies to help, and we didn't have space. And so this was a constant triaging who gets to live and die is a theoretical thing in when we live in the first world that we live in and are quite privileged. And unfortunately, on the ground in Gaza, it's an hour-to-hour reality.
And in that triaging operation that you were doing hour-to-hour, were there often patients that you had to choose not to treat who perhaps could have survived if you were in a position to treat them?
Every day. So every day, you know, myself and my Gazan physician peers and nurses had to make decisions in the moment of who gets the machine to breathe for them, who truly has a chance to survive in an environment where we don't have wound care supplies, we don't have appropriate operating theaters to treat, neurosurgical emergencies. It was an everyday decision every time one of these mass casualties happened, who we'd have to physically move to the edges of the trauma bay because we couldn't help them. And often those patients, unfortunately and sadly, died in front of us and there was nothing to do.
Were there many times in which those patients were children?
I will say that the vast majority of the patients we cared for were children in the trauma and the mass casualty events. You know, 40% of Gaza is under the age of 14. And so every time one of these bombs dropped in civilian populated areas, a vast majority of the people most affected by the blast injuries and the burns were children. And so, yeah, for sure, every single day, I you know, I can't articulate very well the fact that I saw more kids die in my 3 weeks there than I've seen in my entire career, and I expect to see in the rest of my career unless I'm back in Gaza. And so it's a travesty, really.
Now, a campaigner is calling for better protection of Dublin's Molly Malone statue, arguing that public groping of the sculpture's breasts is inappropriate and disrespectful. We're joined now by Trinity College Dublin student and musician Tilly Cripwell. And Tilly, you're very welcome. You're over a year into this campaign now. It's called Leave Molly Malone. What got you started?
Well, I spend a lot of time by the statue because I do a lot of busking there. And I just got sick of seeing so many people, up to 60 people an hour, groping her while I was playing my busking sets there, that I decided I had had enough and wanted to put a stop to it.
And I know, indeed, while there have been moments that have made you quite uncomfortable directed at you while you've been busking by the statue. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, just a week ago, some men touched the statue, did what they needed to do, and then I was standing kind of a way away from it, not really involved, and they just came up and mimed groping me as well, just for a bit of a laugh, which went down really badly, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I suppose you can see then maybe why, as you say, it's disrespectful and inappropriate, but it also, you know, is potentially a very bad idea for other reasons.
Exactly. And that's, I mean, a direct instance where it's setting a bad example, not only to me and people of my generation, but also the younger generations watching.
Well, no, what Fergus was saying in his article was that we should join the fight. And I presume when he says we, he doesn't mean himself. He means my children, your children,
yes, yeah,
the children of people listening and potentially our grandchildren. And, you know, we used to have a saying as junior officers when I was in the army, you know, these old war horses, retired generals would come in, and we used to refer to them as, say, once a fighting cock, now a feather duster. Only, Fergus, you've never served. You've never been in a hostile environment. And you reference Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia. I was there at the end of that conflict as a UN, as an OSCE election supervisor. I've witnessed conflict on all, both in Europe and in the Middle East. And I can tell you, we should not lightly commit our young men and women to conflict zones or to war zones on the basis of a simple government majority. That
okay,
is dangerous.
Can I let Fergus respond to that,
well,
please?
I mean, I'm going to have to say, Tom, I think this is desperately unworthy of you. Really cheap and unworthy. I would give my right arm at the drop of a hat to put myself in harm's way rather than any of my grandchildren or my children or their generation. I can't. I wish I could, but I can't. Okay? And to go around comparing me to feather dusters is just a cheap shot, Tom, which is way beneath you, way beneath you. I was going to say that I utterly agree with most of the arguments that you have put forward, most of them. But when you parade these kind of cheap, nasty shots around, you don't deserve to be listened to.
Well, Fergus, you know, your manufactured outrage. When I read your article yesterday, riddled with inaccuracies and breathless assertions about joining a fight, I must say, I very rarely get annoyed, but I found it. And first of all, you denigrate the service of Irish troops overseas.
No, I do not.
You did, because you said that we never joined the fight. Thousands of Irish troops have joined peace enforcement missions and have put their lives on the line in Europe, in Africa, and in the Asian continent, and you denigrate them in your...
I denigrated my father then. I denigrated my grandfather, both of whom served.
I don't know anything about that. I'm only talking about what you wrote in your article.
You make all sorts of assumptions, though,
Tom.
So
your manufactured outrage. I can give you a reason why I'm annoyed, because I have four children who are of military service age. And what you're suggesting explicitly in your article, and I'm talking about evidence here, you're suggesting that they should go and join some sort of a military coalition to fight. To fight what? To fight where? What's unspecified
conflict?
Nobody
knows the answers to those questions, Tom.